This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When you meet Gary Kieber, the first thing you notice is his unassuming demeanor. He comes across as a man comfortable in his work and his choices. What you can't detect is the circuitous route it took to get where he is today, and how every off-ramp and odd turn would eventually make perfect sense. Gary Kieber is CEO of Scientific Properties, a commercial real estate development company in Durham. They bought the Golden Belt mixed group, a mixed-use complex to life, among other projects. Gary is also the force behind the website Open Durham, which morphed from his blog, Endangered Durham. In the blog, he managed to identify the city's historical and architectural landmarks and write passionately for their preservation. He has several master's degree and, yes, even a medical degree. He was a family care physician for years. Gary came to the Triangle to attend Duke, came back to practice medicine, then stayed to help in the recent transformation of the Bull City. And he joins me in the studio today. Gary Kieber, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thanks so much, Frank.
Started out in New Orleans.
Yeah, I grew up in
there.
New Orleans.
Growing up in New Orleans inform your sense of cityscape, of urbanscape?
Well, I think it influenced it a lot. I grew up right next to the streetcar tracks on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. And New Orleans was a very fairly well-preserved city. It was densely built, old neighborhoods, parks, corner stores, streetcars. And I feel like in a way I grew up in a way different than a lot of my cohort in other places, where the transformation of cities had really changed them to a much more car-dependent environment. So I had a lot of freedom to explore. I took the streetcar to and from school every day. That was very different and gave me a sense of a very sort of dense city, and a city that is sort of built for walking.
Did you have that sense growing up that this was a unique place?
No, I had no sense of it. It was just home.
Yeah,
it was
right.
Just where I grew up. So it wasn't until I came somewhere else that it seemed different or it seemed unique.
And when you got to Durham, you went to med school here.
No, I went to undergrad.
Undergrad here. Yeah. What did you notice about this place? How did this place feel?
At that point, that was 1988, and I came up to go to Duke. And, I remember driving through downtown with my parents on one of the first visits, and I think the adjective that came to mind was dreary.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot. Brightleaf Square had been redeveloped, but really east of that, there wasn't much going on. And I don't think, aside from a couple of times volunteering at various shelters, et cetera, later in my college career, I don't think I made it east of Brightleaf in the next 4 years. But we went to 9th Street, and that was a neat spot. But the focus at that point for Duke students was to get to Chapel Hill, because that's where, the scene was. That's where Cat's Cradle was. That's where you would go out. So we were very focused on Chapel Hill as a destination, not Durham.
You did eventually go to med school. When did you decide you were going to be a doctor?
That's one of those things that is hard to identify. But I know by the time I was in high school, I was very determined that that's what I was going to do.
And you became a doctor, and you had a practice, and you practiced here in Durham.
Yeah.
So how is that going for you? I mean, did you like practicing, or was there something about it that told you right away that I may have to move on?
Well, the interesting thing about medicine is it's very much about delayed gratification. So you spend years sort of waiting to get through the next steps to get out, into practice. So once you get there, I think I had a sense of anticipation that was the great reveal okay, now this was where I wanted to be. So, I don't know when, but it was within the first year that I had some sense of, okay, what next? That this didn't feel like it. This didn't feel like everything that I wanted to do.
And you were doing, you were a primary care doctor.
Yeah.
So what was the thought process then at that point? You could tell yourself on the one hand, well, maybe there's something about this practice that isn't quite right. Maybe it's medicine. What were you thinking?
I was thinking I just spent my entire 20s in a lot of debt.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? What are you thinking here, Gary? So, I had a fantastic practice, great partners, and I loved working with my patients. So, in a way, that was really fortuitous, because I think if that had been really identifiably bad in some way, then I would have probably continued on and tried to perfect the practice, if you will. But because those things were all good, I really had to, you know, sort of, it was me. I mean, I was the problem, not anything external.
So what did you do?
Well, I'd been doing volunteer work for preservation in Durham, and I had been learning about Durham history and working on my house and friends' houses, and so I had had this interest in that, and it was really you know, I'd seen it only as an avocational interest, and then about 2001 or so, Howard Frumkin wrote this article in a medical journal about the connection between place and health, and the connection between urban environments and physical activity, obesity, you know, mental health, asthma, and that just blew me away. It was it felt like now I understood that there was some logical connection. In other words, my own brain made sense to me in some, you know.
Well, what is the connection?
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly, you know, cities that were designed for walking and cities with a lot of density of destinations, actually, people walk more.
Meaning you can get to the pharmacy and the grocery store and the bookstore, and it's all within walking distance.
Right. So, you know, a place like New York, people walk a lot all day long. And on average, they're less heavy than folks that live in more disconnected, car-dependent environments. When you can rely on your feet to take you to public transportation or directly to your destinations, and you have some place to go, that people walk more without having to sort of say, okay, I'm going to join a gym, or I'm going to intentionally go and push myself to exercise 30 minutes a day.
And of course, you can always not go to the gym, but if you're committed to getting the book and getting the groceries, and that's how you get there, you know, you're stuck.
Right.
You
so this kind of, you know, unconscious exercise, if you will, is obviously great, because people can do it, and they do it without having to put a lot of extra effort into it. So, you know, as a result, you know, people, there's less obesity, and the cardiovascular disease that's associated with that is less prevalent.
How much of that observation that walkable cities lead to a more healthy environment was reinforced by the conversations you would have with your own patients and trying to get them to lead healthier lifestyles?
It was reinforced quite a bit. I had patients because often people would come in and want to lose weight and want to be healthier. And we'd talk about exercise and we'd talk about diet. And, you know, one of the conversations, particularly for folks who couldn't necessarily afford a gym or didn't have easy access, you know, to some kind of a track or something like that, was, where am I supposed to walk? I can very vividly remember talking to people who basically had an office out on, you know, a highway somewhere, 15501 or what have you. And I can remember one woman telling me about this tiny little parking lot next to it. And she was doing like 50 laps around this tiny little parking lot because that was the only place that she could get out to walk. And I'd say, well, at least can you walk if you have to eat at these fast food places? Because she was like, I don't have time to make food. Can you walk there? And she'd say, well, there's no way to walk there. I'd get run over if I tried. So yeah, it was very palpable.
So all of this stuff is coming together in your head. But as you say, you are a doctor and you have spent a fair amount of time and money becoming. What did you do? Did you decide then to go back to get a graduate degree in something else, huh?
Yeah, it took me a couple of years of you know, really thinking about whether this was what I wanted to do or not. But in finding this kind of logical connection where it wasn't just that I was going off on a crazy lark to do something with cities that I had no idea what it was at the time, finding this kind of logical connection between what I'd been doing and perhaps what interested me or what I hoped to do made it easier. So, yeah, I practiced for 4 years and then I went back to school to get a master's of public health.
And then another master's in urban planning?
Design? I also did a second residency in preventive medicine, which is sort of the public health, the physician residency version of public health, and then city and regional planning, all at UNC.
All right. So you got plenty of education, plenty of ideas. We'll find out what Gary Kieber did with it as our conversation continues. Gary's the CEO, COO, I should say, of Scientific Properties. He also runs the website Open Durham. And on Tuesday, October 9th, he's going to give a presentation called Untold Durham at the Carolina Theater. More about that when our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, meeting Gary Kieber. He is the CEO of Scientific Properties. Forgive me, Gary. I was looking at an old website that called you something else. CEO of Scientific Properties, also runs the website Open Durham. So when you're in grad school, is that when you started getting involved in preservation, Durham?
Well, I had been involved before that when I was out in practice. So I had, I had worked just as a volunteer and then run a committee called the Endangered Properties Committee that worked on trying to save threatened properties and then eventually joined the board.
And tell us about Endangered Durham and how that got started.
Well, I'd been advocating pretty strongly for both the Preservation Society as well as the city to really reconsider some of their decision making. The city at that point was fairly aggressive about tearing down buildings, particularly in economically disadvantaged neighborhoods, the sort of broad swath of what the city refers to as Northeast Central Durham. And I felt very strongly that this was a mistake, that this doesn't work, that if you've got economic conditions that are creating abandonment, you're not going to improve the economic situation by removing houses. And so Preservation Durham got a good bit of city funding at that point in time and really was not up for challenging the city very directly on what they were doing. And so we had a parting of the ways. And
we've gotten a little trouble for talking about a particular building. Tell us about that.
Well, we had a particular there was a particular house that we had a beautiful house on Andrew Avenue that we had an option on and had found a buyer for. And, we talked to the city about it. And then suddenly it was just bulldozed by the city. And I was irate. I wrote a rather lengthy screed on the ABCD listserv, which was sort of a downtown listserv at that point in time, about how we were not being consistent in our decisions about how we dealt with so-called blighted property as a city. And the Herald Sun said, hey, can we run this as an op-ed? And I said, sure. And so they did. And sort of naively, I put all of my associations at the end of it. He's a student at UNC. He's a former physician and is on the board of Preservation Durham. Well, Preservation Durham was quite unhappy that because they felt like it implied that it was a statement of the board. So they wrote a rebuttal in the paper and kind of distanced themselves. So that's when I started Endangered Durham. I essentially started publishing it anonymously and went by pseudonym and started sort of doing this on my own under the radar.
But it got quite a bit of readership and quite a following, and everybody was trying to figure out who Endangered Durham is, and eventually did.
Yeah, Ray Gromberg from the Herald, I had written a piece, the Royal Ice Cream Parlor, which was a site of a very early sit-in pre-Greensboro and a really important civil rights spot in Durham and in the South had gotten very little recognition kind of from a broader audience at that point. And a church adjacent to the old Royal Ice Cream Parlor tore the building down, and I wrote about this and what a loss of history and what a lost opportunity what this was. They wanted to build a school on the site. They have since built a school on the site, which is wonderful and an asset to the community. But, you know, my major point was, how salient is history? If you preserve this, say, as a history classroom, and you can actually sit in the same spot where this occurred, I mean, how vibrant and alive is history? With how palpable is that if you can be there? And so the Herald picked up on that and wanted to write about it. And Ray Gromberg was a good sleuth and managed to out me. So.
So that's when you had to leave Preservation Durham at
if you were going to
continue to publish.
Right. So I left the board. Yeah.
So, you know, but the struggle, it seems to me, points to an interesting inherent conflict. Cities at some level recognize that there's something about their past and their history that's important. And so they give grants to groups like Preservation Durham, who then are somewhat beholden to the city. And so when it comes down to the crisis, we are going to develop this property because we can get a lot of money for it. It seems like the dollar always wins. I mean, it strikes me that it's very difficult to resist that pressure, even if there's a sense that preservation is a part of our new development.
Well, and particularly now, nonprofits just generally are, you know, really struggle for consistent sources of funding. So, it's hard to raise enough through donor solicitation to really keep going as a niche nonprofit in particular. I think groups in general are more dependent on and like to get consistent sources of funding. So you always have to understand, I think, what trade-off there is with that. Does that really come with no strings attached?
But let's talk about the need for preservation at all. You said it's not going to help you if you have an underserved area where there's not as much financing going into that area. It's not going to help you to knock down houses. Why not? There's a business. If I'm knocking that down because some business is going to go in there and create jobs and pay taxes and all that.
Well, that's, you know, that's the dream. But that's, you know, what's what the city, county, federal government. I mean, this dates back to urban renewal, and this is, you know, part of my frustration with it at the time, and is that there's a kind of a fantasy that if you create a blank slate, that that's suddenly going to become appealing, and that's just not the case. I mean, one of the great fallacies that occurred with urban renewal was the belief that if you cleared all these houses, you know, cleared all this land, created giant parcels. You know, all the stuff from the early 1960s, they always have these renderings of all this modern mall-looking stuff that was going to take its place. Well, it never happened because it was, you know, they just believed it sort of on faith. A lot of the issue is that if a place is economically disadvantaged, you know, why will a private investor invest their money there? Just if they've got other options, there has to be, you know, some other appeal, you know, to investing there. So that if you don't solve some of the problems with the economic fundamentals of unemployment and poverty and all that in an area, you're not going to induce a private investor to put a bunch of money into a neighborhood just by tearing down a house and creating a bank.
But it does seem that therein or around that issue, there are several large gaps. The developers are the folks who can put the money together, and they want you to fix the economic problems. You're the city or the county who's struggling because of these undeveloped areas. You don't have the money to fix them yet. How do you broker some kind of an agreement? Do developers see that as any part of the responsibility? Are cities, do they have enough leverage to force them in a way, or at least convince them that it's in their best interest?
Well, you know, there's always risk involved, and there has to be some kind of gap funding that comes from somewhere in order to make things economically viable. You know, the Golden Belt, would not be possible without federal and state historic tax credits and new market tax credits. So there's risk. There's an inherent risk in investing outside of what is considered, you know, the safe place to develop. You know, it's not down by South Point. It's, you know, it's not over by 9th Street. But, you know, and so some of that risk has to be mitigated somewhere. in order for investors to really put their money behind it.
Talk about open Durham then, because endangered Durham became, in some ways, became open Durham. And talk about the difference between the two and how open Durham, how you came to create that website.
Well, endangered Durham, I started that in 2006, and it was a blog. And I really was wanted to highlight buildings like the one that I mentioned. And you know, my thought of the process at the time was that I would publish maybe 3 weeks worth of material and then kind of update this list of properties. And it very quickly, both, you know, just because I was interested and I'm a little bit obsessive, became, you know, I should tell the story of the buildings that have already been torn down, because you can't really see the full narrative unless because people would say to me, you know, oh, Durham, it's got so much historic architecture. It's just got such an abundance, which I always felt the need to kind of, you know, jump in on that, because I felt like that made it an easy thing to kind of chop off one or two more buildings because, well, we just got such a surplus of these things. So I very quickly began, you know, telling that story as well, and then the story of other buildings. And eventually, you know, 6 years later, I'd published a new story every day for 6 years and developed this sort of archive. You know, not out of intent, not really starting out with that idea, but with just having done it for that long, there was just this bulk of historic information. And so the technology had really improved, and mapping had become so much more sophisticated after the iPhone, and I was very interested in utilizing those aspects, making it a very functional archive. And one of the most important things to me, and the reason for the name change, was I wanted to change the nature of the interaction. I would get these wonderful comments from people who are new to Durham, grew up in Durham, expatriate Durhamites, and I wanted this to be a more participatory growth, and that it was not me publishing and people reacting to it, but that there would be the opportunity to really create a community-sourced archive that could grow and change over time. So
people are sending you photographs, information about that building that used to be there, and then you can map it and plot it on the map, see what's there now, and a picture of what used to be there.
Right. And at this point, I mean, they can create those themselves. So, I mean, they can, if they have a person lives in wherever at this point, they can come in, upload a scan of their childhood home in Durham and write the history of it. And, you know, the time their, you know, father, you know, got the car stuck, you know, in the ditch or whatever else, you know, and tell those stories, because those are the things that are, it's very hard for an organization just talking about nonprofits and how they have to work to sustain themselves, to for one organization or to sort of for the stewardship of this to fall to any one organization, you're going to lose a lot. You're going to lose a lot of history, because there aren't enough resources to go out and have a person proactively collect all of that information.
So you've got the kind of Wikipedia of Durham history, in a sense. People are contributing. But why is historic preservation important? You've made a case for why the urban renewal plans of the 60s and 70s were failures. Don't just clear it. But what's the importance of the historic nature? Why do we have to preserve it? If I come to you with a plan and I say, Gary, I've got an idea. We're going to put the office space in here. We got to knock down that historic building. Now I'm telling you, I can develop that thing. So it's not just it's not a pipe dream. Why is historic preservation important?
Right, and it's definitely a more challenging question when it's phrased in that way, that you're actually a trade-off between a palpable, guaranteed project versus, you know, just we're tearing it down for a sort of a idea that something might happen. But there are a number of different arguments about it. You know, there's a sustainability argument. You've got both the sort of resources that went into constructing this building initially, the sort of the energy, the all the work that went into building it, and then the resource extraction and new work that has to go into creating whatever is going to replace it. So, you know, you're fundamentally losing some potential energy that is stored in that building. And so, you know, there are a number of studies out there about just how much you're losing. And even if you replace that with a LEED building or something that is otherwise environmentally sound, how many years it actually takes to overcome the loss of that energy. And it's decades. So
is there any way to quantify what maintaining the character of a city and those stories that you talked about that are attached to them? Is there a way to quantify that and say, well, that also has material value?
That, I mean, it's harder, and there's always pressure to quantify that in some way, particularly where you're talking about, you know, dollars and, you know, potential investment dollars. And so there's always pressure to respond to that argument with something. And you tend to lose out a lot of times when you start getting into, you know, people's eyes glaze over a little bit when you talk about things that are, quote, fuzzy, like, you know, life stories and that kind of thing. But it's very important. And, you know, it's the thing that is most powerful to me is I believe very strongly, as I alluded to with the Royal Ice Cream parlor, that being able to reach out and touch a place and walk the same stairs, you know, walk the same hallways, makes history so much more tangible than if you've just got one of those gray and black, you know, steel plaques by the side of the road that said this once stood here.
Well, even if you don't have the chart and the graph that can somehow show it on your PowerPoint presentation, it seems to me that has to be part of the explanation for why Durham has done so well in a recession, given its reputation, given the image that this city had, to be one of the shining stars and the fastest rising cities economically, has to be, you have to account to some degree for its sense of place, the way it looks, the way people feel about the buildings that are here.
Yeah, I think so. And this is, to a great degree, what I'm going to talk about in the presentation next week. But, you know, they're like overarching economic drivers, obviously, you know, Duke Hospital, you know, the university, RTP, et cetera, that helped Durham a great deal and give a lot of us employment I started saying economic safety net, but it's more than that. It's a strong economic driver, and it's one of the more recession-proof economic drivers. What's interesting to me is that people have come to Durham for 150 years for that kind of economic opportunity. And the interesting thing is not that they come for that opportunity, but that they stay. And, you know, I'm one of those people, as many people I've talked to, who came and, you know, sort of without, you know, here's an opportunity and I may be here a couple of years. And, you know, I have many friends who then 15 years later, they just, it's home. And the reason for that, obviously, people form social connections and have kids in school, et cetera. But there is something else. There is Durham is an endlessly fascinating place, and there's sort of a great counter narrative that always runs underneath the surface about Durham's grittiness and various other words that we use to kind of try to capture what that is about Durham, its uniqueness, its, you know, its iconoclasts, you know, the people who are always doing something a little bit weird and fun and unusual.
So how does a guy who makes a living, in a sense, telling people to preserve buildings, not to knock them down, don't make space for developers, how does he become the CEO of a development company like Scientific Properties?
Well, fortunately, the Andy Rothschild and I were very aligned in terms of our development priority.
Andy founded the company.
Yes. So people ask me, you know, does this become a conflict? And it never has, you know. And part of the good reason for that is, you know, beyond just the kind of values of history and preservation, you know, in and of itself, is that it makes a lot of economic sense to redevelop historic properties. It's particularly if you can factor in historic tax credits and other economic reasons, it's a better business proposition. So it doesn't really have to be an issue that causes conflict for.
Well, and Andy, I mean, found you and picked you. He asked you to come to the company, right?
Yeah.
To help develop Golden Belt. So it wasn't as though he felt there was conflict. There was something precisely about what you were doing that he felt matched the goals of Scientific Properties in that case.
Right.
Well, let's talk more about that. We'll take a break now. We'll come back. We'll talk about Golden Belt, how that develops, and the future of the city of Durham and urban planning in general as we continue our conversation with Gary Kieber, CEO of Scientific Properties. Next Tuesday, October 9th, going to talk to a fundraiser give a talk called Untold Durham, and that'll happen at the Carolina Theater October 9th, but our conversation continues in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest today, Gary Kieber, CEO of Scientific Properties, also runs the website Open Durham. So we talked about developing Golden Belt. We should maybe have you describe it for us, because that was a bit of a risk given the fact that it was just off the edge and at the eastern end, on the east side of Durham, just past downtown. Tell us what it is and how it developed.
Well, Golden Belt is a former textile mill. It made the bags for Bull Durham tobacco, pre-cigarettes, the loose leaf tobacco. And so it actually processed and sewed those bags. It survived a lot longer than a lot of the textile mills in Durham, partly because it was so intimately connected to tobacco. But by 1994, Brown and Williamson had acquired it and essentially gave it to the Durham Housing Authority for a dollar. So it was, you know, fairly dormant for years after that. The Housing Authority worked on it a little bit and formed a sort of job training center in a little section of it, but then decided to sell it off. And so we purchased it in 2006. And so we redeveloped it over 2007 to 2008, 160,000 square feet into a combination of office space, retail space, artist studios, and apartments. We opened in late summer, early fall 2008, which was not the best time to bring a real estate development onto the market. The artist studios in particular are a really core part of the identity of the place, and they filled up right away and have remained a really core piece of its identity.
And, of course, that's one of the big complaints about any kind of development. You move out the artists who've taken over basically squatting the loft space, et cetera, and all of the funky stuff that made it cool, you drive them out and become something else. You become a different neighborhood. So apparently the plan was to somehow figure out a way to keep the artists there.
Right. Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, I think it's this makes a lot of sense, you know, from a business perspective as well. I mean, obviously, if you're trying to bring people to a place that is just over the curve of the earth in Durham, just east of kind of where the energy was in downtown, there has to be a reason to come. So art is one of those wonderful reasons to come to a place that you've never been before and wouldn't have considered going before.
But you've got to commit a lot of space to what I would think would be a kind of lower rent scale than what you would get if that were retail space or if it were condos or that sort of thing.
Well, no doubt. It is not a great moneymaker. It is not a moneymaker in and of itself. And it has to be part of – it makes sense as part of a mixed-use development, you know, wherein, you know, it's part of the whole and you're not looking at what's the ROI just on this one building that has artists in it. You're looking at, you know, what is the performance of the whole project. So sometimes when people come and, you know, say, I want to imitate exactly what you did with these artist studios, I say, okay, how are you going to make it work?
So. Right. And finance it. But before we get into that question of who's going to wait for that kind of return on investment, because it's going to be slower. You're going to make it, but it's going to be slower. So I want to talk about that in a second. But there was another problem that you faced in that neighborhood, which is that the buildings itself were in pretty good shape. But then you've got a lot of abandoned property all around it, and it didn't look like a healthy neighborhood. There are a couple of approaches to that. You can clear it all and make it look better, but you chose not to take that approach.
Yeah, I mean, the buildings had been bricked up and very dark inside and kind of scary. And so there was a bit of the buildings had to be fairly transformed in a way, too, in order to get people, because a lot of folks see that kind of dark hole when you walk inside the building and say, this place is scary and I don't think it can ever be good. So it requires some work just to kind of get people to literally see the light without as well. But yeah, the neighborhood just adjacent to Golden Belt was built by that original company, Golden Belt Manufacturing Company, as a mill village, which was not uncommon at the turn of the 20th century to provide housing for mostly rural to urban migrants who were coming to work in the factories. And it had been owned entirely by the company until 1954, at which point they sold it off. But, you know, the neighborhood had really become much more economically disenfranchised over decades from the 60s onward. And by the time we contemplated doing Golden Belt, it had about a 5% home ownership rate, lots of abandoned housing. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about what is our approach here. And, you know, do we, one of our big decisions was, you know, do we put up a fence? And, you know, because, you know, at that point it was, there was obvious crime occurring on the streets. And, you know, so it was one of our decisions that I feel really happy about, that we just said, we're gonna go as the neighborhood goes, and we're not gonna put up any fence, and we're going to be an open campus. And then the next question is, how do you involve yourself in the revitalization of the neighborhood, but do so in a way that is not heavy-handed? How do you try to avoid the sort of the mistakes of, you know, any kind of organization that kind of says, oh, I have a solution and I'm going to fix you? You know, well, people, you know, they don't necessarily want to be fixed. They want to be part of the solution to the problem. So we had a great partner in working in the neighborhood in Habitat for Humanity who was starting to acquire some properties in the neighborhood as well. And then I met with a number of people in the neighborhood, and there was a great couple, Antoine and Deidreana Freeman, who lived on Worth Street, and they were very excited about being part of forming a neighborhood association. And so helped hook them up with some resources and to get that off the ground. And then we really, the decision that I made was, you know, that we were only going to acquire abandoned properties. And to do so kind of incrementally and carefully, so that we could at each point, you know, sort of assess, are we still on the right track? Are we, you know, are we doing too much, too little? And so we were acquiring abandoned properties, sometimes, you know, at non-economic prices.
Well, because people who hang on to those properties in many cases have this dream that someday the freeway is going to go through and they're going to be multimillionaires. And so in other words, you're not going to sell really at the going rate for that house.
Yeah. When you come as a developer who suddenly has bought this and people have dollar signs in their eyes. And so, you know, you know, again, it's one of these things where it's a holistic endeavor. And, you know, we're really fortunate that the people who provide the money to us are really good people and don't require every aspect or every small section that one does to provide some major profit, because it's the work we've done in the neighborhood is a money losing endeavor for us taken on its own.
And you've actually got people now working. Obviously, time is being spent out of your office doing neighborhood development and organizing, helping people who have already decided to start a neighborhood organization to go to City Hall, to get the streetlights put in, to get the sidewalks fixed, all the things that would, you know, inhibit crime. But you're not doing it. The neighbors are, and you're just fostering that, meaning some of your income is going to that cause.
Right. So, you know, we basically acquired a couple of houses and then started renovating those houses. And then when I resold them, I was, you know, what I wanted to do was put owner occupancy covenants on those houses, because, you know, and Habitat, obviously their model also was to create owner occupancy. So we really wanted the, you know, a lot of the consensus seems to be that somewhat of a 50-50 mix in a neighborhood between owner occupancy and rental is a fairly stable mixture. And so we at least wanted to get closer to that than five.
Right, right.
You know, we worked on houses incrementally and sold them to homeowners, have done a whole variety of approaches to that. So we've done renovations on 9 houses. Habitat's also done 9 houses, and we're at close to a 30% home ownership rate in the neighborhood
now. And how about Golden Belt? How is it doing as a property?
It's doing well. The artist studios and the apartments have stayed full from the get go, and we've got a great set of retailers now. Blend Cafe and Bikram Yoga and Dog Star Tattoo and, you know, Labor Love. And, you know, so we've got a nice variety of things to for people to come out and enjoy, and office tenants, you know, who are there as well. So we're about 90% leased at this point. And, you know, it's come into its own. It's taken longer than we would have, you know, thought it was, you know, in summer of 2008, but as to be expected.
Well, so tell me a little bit more about that, because you mentioned it, and I'd like to hear more about investors who are willing no investor wants to lose money. So they need to know that you know what you're doing as a developer and that this thing is going to make money, but that they're willing to wait a little bit for the profit, a kind of slow money ethic that seems to be what your investors seem to embrace.
Well, you know, that I feel very fortunate to be in that situation, because a lot of times we could be dealing with a situation where people were demanding that every sort of step that we do in the process created a 20% return on investment, and just a refusal to invest further at that point. And, you know, in a situation where, you know, we've had quite a few tenants who, you know, have struggled, and we've been patient with, and, you know, for them to be able to get through tough times, you know, without investors kind of up the line who are kind of willing to be patient with you and with those tenants, you can't carry projects like this forward.
But it's a sustainable project, and one that can ultimately, if it all pays off, start to bring lots of areas of Durham together and make this whole thing connected.
Right. It's just over a longer time horizon. And so being willing to kind of look at the big picture and look at a sort of what the ultimate time horizon is crucial.
So that really leads to, and maybe you partly answered my next question, which is, how do you stay in business after a recession like this where money is so tight and still pretty tight? I know you've got lots of projects that you would like to get going on, properties you own and would like to develop, can't because the money isn't there yet. How do you stay in business?
Well, I think you're prudent in just what you're doing right now. You focus on being very careful with the decisions you're making with the projects you have. So, you know, the real shift that's occurred, particularly in the real estate world, is that pre-2008, there was a lot of speculative development that was happening. There was a lot of you know, build it and they will come, and a lot of conviction in that. And that's just not feasible at this point.
Well, even if the business plan failed, I've got the property, and that's going no place but up. That's pre-2008. So,
right.
So that was the bet.
Right. So you really have to be very, you know, things that any business person would do in this kind of situation. You have to try to spend only what you have to, and try to maximize everything you do. Look for very crucial areas to improve your property and maintain your property, and you know, just be wise about that. And then also, you know, be conservative about new projects. So, you know, we've got sites that we'd love to develop, you know, but we're not going to do those until you know, it makes economic sense to do it. Because, you know, right now there's still not corporate headquarters floating around just saying, oh, will somebody please build me a building. You know, that's, you know, there are a few of them, you know, and they're very coveted.
Yeah, but it is hard to explain, isn't it? It is for me hard to understand how Wall Street's been doing very well for years now, and yet still we're talking about how difficult it is to find jobs, how difficult it is to get money to do these projects that there's great enthusiasm and energy around. Where's the misconnection there?
Well, I think a lot of people from, you know, small business owners like us to all the way up that are still kind of in banks that are in a very conservative mindset of not really knowing what the pathway is, what the trajectory is. And so, you know, even if they're doing better and or they're seeing more activity, there's a great deal of uncertainty still about what's happening next year. And particularly because we've had so many kind of fits and starts with this where people say, well, we really think the signs look good and we're going to be out of this in 6 months. And then 6 months, it's a, you know, another debt crisis somewhere pops up.
So on October 9th, you're doing this event called Untold Durham at the Carolina Theater. Tell us about that. Give us a preview, if you would.
Yeah, it's kind of an expansion on an idea I've really enjoyed for a while, which is the reason why people stay in Durham. And Durham, sometimes I have the feeling that, you know, whenever somebody comes to Durham, they have a sense that, you know, it started to get cool, you know, whenever a couple of years after they came. And there's a sense that, well, Durham was just kind of for a long time before that. And the farther you get into Durham history and the more interesting it becomes, so especially to me. And I feel like there's kind of a narrative that people know, which, you know, roughly goes, you know, Dawn of Time, Civil War, tobacco, textiles, Duke, Black Wall Street, Durham dies, food trucks.
I think that's the story. Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, Durham was a fascinating place, you know, and some of even before it was Durham, it was kind of a rough and tumble. That old roaring place was how they referred to the Hillsborough to Raleigh Road, which was where Durham was located. It was that kind of place, you know, before it was ever Durham, and that's still in its DNA.
Well, you can hear more October 9th, but Gary, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
Gary Kieber, CEO of Scientific Properties, also runs the website Open Durham. And on Tuesday, October 9th, he hosts a fundraiser called Untold Durham at the Carolina Theater. For more information, check out opendurham.org. Thank you for checking out our program, The State of Things, directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Nguyen and Nicole Campbell. Hallie Scott is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Susan Davis is the senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.